I'll never forget, and that should be the last two flights that I ever had with that aircraft. I had contracted to take Brad Washburn, the mountain climber, into the Yukon, the St. Elias Range in the Yukon Territory, and land him on a glacier adjacent to Mount Lucania, which had never been climbed, and land him there. Well, in the spring of the year, I successfully landed up there three times at almost 9,000 feet on Walsh Glacier, and landed his supplies, and agreed to take him in June. And my experience with the snow around Valdez on there had been, there was a very heavy snow and was solid, and I could find places between the crevasses on there where I could land without going through. But as I say, when I landed Brad up on the top of this mountain in 1937, I found a far different quality of snow up there than it had been around the coastal area of Valdez. It was nothing but frost, and I went through the first thing I landed down there. Within seconds, I had gone through up to the belly and wings of the plane, then into this soft snow, which was actually nothing but slush, and with a temperature there about 60 or 70 degrees on there, which was even warmer than it was down in the coast. Well, to make a long story short, it took me 5 days to get the aircraft out of there, and the airplane took a terrible beating in and out of the crevasses, and the starting and stopping, and the full power that I had to use to go and maneuver to get it off, and as I say, pull out of the crevasses. Well, I got home one day on there. I got back from that trip. It was about 300 miles from Valdez. Well, I got into Valdez on there. I landed on there, and I was on my last drop of gas. In fact, for 10 cents, I'd open up that tank and thrown a match in it, and there wouldn't have been an explosion. Well, I didn't do any more flying that day on there, because I never expected to get out of that place alive. But nevertheless, I still had to continue making a living, and I'd been flying a bunch of timbers down to a mine that I had found and sold in Columbia Glacier, and it was called the Rough and Tough Mine. Rough and Tough Mine got its name from my name and my partner Thompson on there. A wag in the grocery store had seen some supplies going out there, and he'd said, "Who's that for?" "Reuben Thompson." And he says, "Yes, well then," I says, "that's the Rough and Tough Mine." So the mine was named after it, and hence it got its name, as I say. In any event, I was on my way with a load of mining timbers, and all at once my engine quit again on there. And the amazing part of that engine had waited until I was just 10 or 15 minutes after I had made the other flight, and had got out of the got back safely from this perilous flight in from Walsh Glacier. In any event, there I was in the no place to land, on the crevices, and there was a mine close there named the Cliff Mine, and I knew about that time that it was about noon, and there would be a shift going from work back in the tunnel, and my only thought of salvation had to ditch in the ocean out there, and hope somebody would see me and come out and pull me out in case I'd been trapped in the airplane. Well, I landed all right on the spit near the mine, about a mile from the mine, and when I came to rest with the skis on, I had been flying off the mud flats with skis up into the glacier, and I'd been very successful. And I landed, and there was only about 2 feet of water, so I stepped off the skis, expecting to walk to shore, and all at once I went down to my neck. The aircraft had come to emplane on the water and come to rest on the top of a series of boulders. Well, there I was on there. There was about a 20 or 30 knot wind blowing and drifting me out in the cold water. The water is very cold, and the ice in there, and as you well know, you cannot survive on that very long. Well, I managed to make it to shore, but I could not make the last 20 or 30 feet, because I was due to the chill and the and exhaustion on there, I just could not. I was just wallowing around there like a wet log. In any event, old Charlie Simon's dad, who operated the mine down there, had seen me, and he ran. He knew I was in trouble. He ran out and he ran a whole mile, and he got me out, and he ran and waded out and pulled me to shore, and rolled me over a log, and resuscitated me and took me, and then I was able to walk down the mine, get some dry clothes on. Well, that was the. I spent almost a year rebuilding that airplane. It had become soaked in the water. We got it out finally when the tide went out. And the day that I got it finished, I got to thinking of the many forced landings that I had with that aircraft, and I decided that I didn't want to swim in anymore, and I'd about run out of luck. So I never assembled the airplane, and it's still there over in Valdez, I suppose. I think they're making a museum out of it or something on there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Well, years later on there, many times in retrospect, I used to wonder how was my luck that the law averages had been sound asleep for the 8-9 years that I used that aircraft, and that's my only conclusion, that the law averages was sound asleep during that period. In retrospect, I want to get back now. I haven't told you how I first started to land on the glaciers. I did relate how the economy of the community seemed to be predicated upon the rehabilitation of the gold mines in the area. Well, none of those gold mines were ever in an accessible spot. They were in the worst spots you could ever conceive of to attempt of landing. And the other pilots around the area had shunned any attempt to go and give any service to these places. There was a fellow named Jack Cook. They called it the Big Four Mine. It's about 6,000 feet altitude up in Brevere Glacier. And on top of the mountain, a couple of thousand feet from the mine, was a narrow shelf on the top of the mountain. It had been snowed in. It was about a 30 degree upgrade, and it was only about 700 or 800 feet long. Well, one day, I thought I'd better make good in some of my allegations that I had made down in the pool hall on Saturday night about my ability to carry through on the landing, so I took off. Well, I headed for this glacier on there, but I didn't realize till then the extreme grade of the thing, and I had no perspective, and the first thing I knew, I'd flown smack into the side of the top of this the mountain on there, right in the soft snow. Well, I was belted in, and I didn't get any shock, but the fellow who was with me was catapulted up in the cockpit with me on there. Of course, the propeller stopped immediately. Well, we dug the airplane out and made a shelf we could take off, and I just turned it around and headed downhill, and we got off. Well, I tried it again on there, but the next thing I did, I got a bunch of black gunny sacks, and I dropped them up and down there so I would be able to go and see the snow. So I started low and with full power started climbing uphill, and I made the first successful landing there. Then I put a row of flags along about every 30-40 feet apart, and I would aim at those flags on a climb and hit it just like shooting a rifle at a target on there. And I never had a bit of trouble after that with that technique. And because you couldn't make a normal landing, you couldn't get your plane in a glider or anything on there, because due to the extreme rise in the ground, you would hit it with a terrific impact. And as I said, the proper technique was to get below it and then shoot for it just like shooting a rifle, cut your with full power, maybe 100 miles an hour, and then cut the gun, and you wouldn't run over 200 or 300 feet in the snow. And getting off was easy. You just turn it around and give it the gun, and you were in airborne within 100, 200 or 300 feet on there. Well, after that, we flew in 40, 50 tons in there, and that mine became in production on there, and then I used the technique on the half a dozen other mines around there. In the meanwhile, I had a little gold fever around there myself. I became imbued with the talk of the Renaissance of Alaska and there. And when I was a boy, I had three ambitions in life. One was to have a 10 gold handicap polo, and another was to fly around the world in 24 hours, and the third was to come make $1 million. Well, it wasn't very possible that I'd go and achieve these desires. I'd found my masters of polo down in South America, and the B-70, the supersonic airplane, had not yet been manufactured. Remember, that was some 28, 29 years ago, where we don't have our modern jets doing almost Mach 1. So I can see it, and so I thought I would find my own gold mine. And in flying over Columbia Glacier, I found a very rich outcrop. But this was in the summer on there, and of course there's no snow on the field down in Valdez, so I can see the technique of going out and using the mud flats down there and skis. Well, actually, the efficiency of skis on the mud was far superior to snow, because oftentimes snow is either deep or it's sticky on there, and presented hazards in many cases to an efficient operation. Consequently, I got this technique, and the salt water did considerable damage to the aircraft and the skis. However, I got stainless steel on the skis on there, and it turned out very successful. I almost lost my life on one of these days on there. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for our present governor on there, Bill Egan. Bill was a young lad then, about 20 on there, and he wanted to learn the business. So, like a lot of the old-time flyers around there, we eagerly accept the service of these boys as what we call swampers on there. They helped load the plane, and you didn't pay them little or anything, but the idea was that the experience was to rub off on them, and they would that was their compensation for, and along with their being part of what we call the love of the game. In any event, I had a flight one morning, and supposed to get out at about 5 o'clock, and Bill lived a short distance from me, and I was staying in a little log cabin there, and it was a very cold night that night. And like a lot of those old cabins, they're susceptible to leaks of the wind. The wind was blowing 40, 50 miles an hour. And so I got an electric heater. I propped up a blanket over me and got an electric heater in there and shining on, reflecting the heat on me to keep warm. Well, as Bill tells it on there, to make a long story short, he came to call me at 4 o'clock in the morning. During the night, I had knocked down the stick that held my blanket up, and the blanket was on fire, and I was suffocating. Of course, that's painless. You never know you do it. And he got me out there and in the fresh air. And time I came to, I didn't do any flying that day, but it's one of those strange things that happen in life, and I must relate that as part of the old time flying days. And in fact, I had even forgotten about the incident until Bill related it the other day on there. He asked me if I remembered at the time. He pulled me out when I was in the cabin, was almost on fire. Well, I want to get back to the gold mine. I eventually staked this. That's the rough and tough mine that I was telling you about, a very, very rich piece of property on there. And for a couple of years after that, when flying was poor, I used to fly down there and knock out high grade that was worth $1 or $2 a pound, and knock it out and sell it through the bank on there. And as I said, I later sold the mine, and it turned out to be a good little mine. But however, the war came along and all gold mining stopped. Those old type airplanes were built very strong in those days, and the beatings that I used to take landing on the glaciers and the ice hummock and going down the crevices on there, the stress on those airplanes and what it would take was incredible on there. I never forget one time I was flying along and I had a whiteout, And there was a Marine ahead of me, and I flew smack into the Marine, and it threw me up about 100 feet in the air, bounced me off there. I glanced off, fender broke my neck, snapped my neck off, and continued on into Valdez and examined the airplane, and the complete cluster that held the whole fuselage and everything together had completely severed down there. Well, I just got a welding torch and got some material two or three times as strong, and I fixed it up so that it would, so the next time I hit one on there that I wouldn't have to do it over again. While telling about those days, I must relate another very, very great flyer, a very great flyer we had in that community flying out of Cordova Valley named Harold Gillum. Harold is not with us anymore. He perished as a result of a forced landing in Ketchikan, near Ketchikan in the war in 1943. But he was the, in my estimation, Harold Gillum was the greatest of them all when it came to flying ability, daring, ingenuity, and the real pioneering work we had around here. The things he's done on there, around here, he's done more varied things in Alaska on there than I would say almost all the rest of them put together. Achievements was starting the first scheduled airline between Fairbanks and Valdez and Cordova on there with an old Pilgrim, which was built by Fairchild in the early 30s on there. He was on the search for Levinsky when he was lost going over the pole in about 37 or 38 on there. He did some very fine flying in that respect, trying to locate that plane there. Later on, he did some of the first weather research with his Pilgrim over there in Fairbanks on there, and he used to go up 10,000-15,000 feet in all kinds of weather, instrument flying on there, plotting the winds and everything on there. Result of his research that contributed very greatly to the knowledge of upper air currents. He next started the regular scheduled airline between Fairbanks and Bethel via McGrath on the Kuskokwim, and they say the residents of that area used to set their clocks by the time Harold went by, regardless of the weather. Pilots, he flew, and regardless of the weather, Gillum was in there. I don't know how he was able to see. Some people said the more envious one said he had cat's eyes, but he knew the country well, and his airplane had a very fine visibility in his cockpit up ahead, and I contribute his success to a considerable degree to the good visibility that he had down there. I said again, at hazard of being repetitious, Gillum of the greatest we had here. Well, in 1936, I got married, and I started to raise a family, and at the end of 39 or 40, I had a couple of children, and the economy of Valdez had not quite kept up with the requirements of which suited suitable to a happy bachelor on there with a little financial outgoing, except maybe for a meal or in a place to sleep, and maybe a quart of moon down at old Doc Singletary, who was our woods chemist we had there down there on Saturday night when Gillum would come in town, and we would have a great time. As I said, so I had to seek brighter pastures, so I decided to move to Fairbanks. And so one day, my old Fairchild, we moved out there. I'll never forget that trip on there with the two kids and the cat and my mother-in-law and wife and myself. We got in Fairbanks, it was 60 below. Fortunately, I had enough to pay a down payment on a house, and the house was warm because in those places it had to be warm in the winter because otherwise the pipes all froze up. I did quite a bit of bush flying around Fairbanks, and then came the threat of World War II there, and our nature's leaders predominantly Hap Arnold, who was chief of the Air Force then, began to realize the backwardness of Alaska for air nav aids and communications and good fields to have for our bombers and fighters in event we ever had an attack on there. As a result, there's a little known facet of that. Congress was very backward and reluctant to give any money for the development of Alaska. However, Arnold knew the threat, and he got all the contractors together, and he says, we haven't got any money, but I think I can get the money next year. Do you want to pitch in and build these fields and take a chance on Congress getting your money? And they all agreed. And I think, from what I heard, these fields, after these fields were built and no money to pay him for them yet, that Hap Arnold and a few of these contractors pretty went to jail. In any event, Congress eventually became aware of the threats of our enemies, principally Japan on the west coast then, and these fields were built. And it was very fortunate for King Pearl Harbor, and we had one of the finest systems of airfields on the western hemisphere. I played a major part in hauling in freight and the construction of these airfields, and not only that, but I took all the people around from the CAA and the Air Force, and we surveyed new locations for these fields. The predominant field that I worked on was the one called Northway, which is supposed to be a usable emergency field between Whitehorse and Fairbanks. I hauled in the summer of 1941. I hauled in 1,100 tons of materials on there, all enough for all the radio towers, the houses there, and everything to go on that. And in the December of that year, that was a usable field down there. It got down to 60, 70 below that fall, and incidentally, Northway is one of the coldest places on the western hemisphere, and I had to suspend operations. Well, that for the first time in my life since the bear market interfered in my luck, I had a stake, and so I went out and bought several more airplanes of my own. I want to tell about one airplane I used in that, principally on that haul. It was an old Boeing 88, which I had bought from the Charlie Babb Company. It was one of six airplanes originally built by Boeing for United Airlines for their transcontinental flight, and it was some airplane in those days. Although it had three engines, four wings, and three tails on there, and it was an excellent performer. And in view of the fact, even though it only licensed to haul 3,400 or 4,000 pounds on there, I had the people who rebuilt the aircraft. We had it beefed up, and there, and with the trusses underneath it on there. And I used to haul individual pieces weighing up to 10 or 11,000 pounds, and never took off with less than 8 or 9,000 pounds in the aircraft. We and those old type engines on there, we had many failures and many instances on there. That airplane would fly almost as good on two engines as it would on three, and I never had any trouble in that respect, as I say, with these overloads on there. Well, on the 7th of December came Pearl Harbor, and naturally all Alaska went on a wartime basis on here, and I want to tell you about our defenses that time. We had about three or four B-18s and half a dozen P-36 fighters. That was the defenses of Alaska, and they started rushing in all kinds of aircraft on there for our defense on there. And first, I want to tell you that winter before, I had participated with the Air Force. It was the Air Corps then, and the cold weather tests up in Ladd Field and on there, because they had never had any real cold weather experience before. And a result of the techniques that they found out and everything on there, that they were able to operate that winter, first year of the war, and in subsequent years on there. I remember very well one of the Air Corps men who had this first B-17 up there. His name was Captain Dick Freeman. He was later killed in the same B-17 while testing ice conditions down in Nevada. He was one of the great heroes of World War II, even though he never got in combat. Well, as I said, Pearl Harbor came along, and as I had this stake, so I went down to the States and I got another 80A of this Boeing's, and I got another Fairchild 71 and a Hamilton down there. The Hamilton is an all metal plane manufactured in Milwaukee that had been originally used by Northwest Airlines on its mail run and passenger run between Chicago, St. Paul, and down to the West Coast in Seattle on there. Well, unfortunately, the pilot, one of several pilots I had hired wrecked this airplane on the way up, and I ended up here with a Fairchild and the Boeing 80A. I almost lost the Fairchild that spring before I got back, because they decided to build, part of the strategy of the war there in early 42 was that the final attack on Japan would come through the Pacific Northwest and Alaska, down through the Aleutians, and or down the Kuriles or through Kamchatka. At that time, we considered the Russians an ally of ours, and did not realize that their real aim in life in later years was to dominate the world, and that their association with us was only of a temporary nature. In any event, I took this Fairchild and I ran the route for the railroads, starting at Prince George to Nome. We went from Prince George, British Columbia, up to Watson Lake, up through the Finley Forks, through Watson Lake, up on the Francis River and the Pelly River, down the Pelly, over to what is now Tok Junction, and then all the way out to Nome. Well, I finished that on there. Incidentally, there's one pass on there, I think, which bears my name, and it's a pass on between the Pelly River and the Francis River on there. They gave the name Reeve Pass. The people who were on that survey were known, was a colonel in the engineers and an old-timer named Fred Hansen, who was one of the original builders of the Copper River Railroad. They always stated that they were the first one over this railroad on there, but I was actually the first, because I sat 4 feet ahead of them in the cockpit of that old Fairchild. On the way back, I almost lost my aircraft. I landed on the ice in front of the roadhouse at Burwash Landing on Kluane Lake, which is in Yukon Territory. And at that time, they were building the Alaska Highway, and they had about 100 construction workers there, and they seen the plane. They all ran out. It was at the spring of the year near the breakup, and the ice was rubbery, and the way those men on there, the ice caved in. My airplane went down through the ice up to the wings. Well, that was one of the saddest days of my life on there, to see this fine airplane, which figure was lost. In any event, an Indian. In any event, the next morning, an Athabaskan Indian named Jimmy Joe there, who was a lot of those people who live in the country, were very ingenious, and he rigged up a boom and some logs and with a chain on it. We lift that airplane up and got it out of the hole in the ice and moved over to solid ice. Well, I drained the carburetor and changed all the plugs and actually started on there, and I flew it off over to a small clearing near to the lake. Of course, it was not fit to fly, and I continued on there due to the generosity of an old friend of mine named who was presently then president of Northwest Airlines, and he was running a supply DC-3 trip up there on a survey to build more fields and run an airline up there. He took me all the way down to Spokane, and I was back in business then. I got my old ADA and continued on to Alaska. When I returned there after about 5 or 6 months, we were building these aircraft down there. Alaska had changed an awful lot. They had a lot of security around here, and I had quite a time getting in. We had to have radio in those days, and I never had any radio, and I had to install a radio on my aircraft, and which I never used very much on there. I'd go through the passes on it there just to please them, but I had to, but being a pilot and mechanic, loader and unloader, and chief accountant, and in general the chief executive of Reeve Airways, I had already had my hands full without learning about the radio. But nevertheless, it was a necessity, and so I installed it, and they found it very, very, first time in my life, I recognized that I'd been bypassing a very valuable institution on there for weather and keeping somebody from flying into you and general communications on there. Then I was very busy flying there in 1942, the first year of the war, and then of course Pearl Harbor had come along. Correction, the Japs had bombed Dutch Harbor on there, and there was a tremendous buildup of the Aleutians. And however, I, to the CAA and all the contractors, I was busy day and night hauling supplies and oil and everything into the new fields they were building and personnel on there. And then at the end of 42 on there, I got a contract with the Alaska Communication System, which is a branch of the Signal Corps, and they whose jobs were building up the communications of Alaska on there. And between my Fairchild and the Boeing ADA, I was busy all the time, flying all the time, day and night, and with the mechanical work, which I did myself, has got a job that would keep, well, it was the old example of anybody who likes work can have a wonderful time in this business on here. And I lost the Boeing in 1943. I'll never forget that day. It was the 6th of July, 1943, and I had been pushing the weather very much in all my flights down there, and I had a piece of emergency radar equipment for Amchitka. Amchitka is one of the Aleutian Islands, which is about 1,600 statute miles east west of Anchorage, in which they a lot of fighter planes, in which they were engaged in softening up Kiska for the invasion of Kiska, as well as that too. In any event, I got into Cold Bay, which is 640 statute miles west of Anchorage, at about 10 o'clock at night, and just as I was making approach the airfield, it fogged in. Well, I stayed around there for about half an hour, trying to get into Cold Bay, in between the drifting fog banks, and wasn't too worried, because about 10 miles south of there was an old lake bed, which I knew I could land on if it didn't close in. In any event, by the time I got to the old lake bed, it suddenly closed in, and there I was on top of the fog at about 1,000 feet with about half an hour's gas, eight passengers, and this radar equipment, no place to go. And of course, there was nothing new in my life on there. I had a number of situations like this, but this was about the worst I ever found myself in. But as I said, I knew I was going to do something. I was always born with the facility when the chips were down, that I did the best thinking and the best flying I ever did. And Pavlov Volcano was about 50 miles from there. And I figured taking the airplane over and stashing it on the side of Mount Pavlov on there. However, when I got over there, I saw that I knew that I didn't have quite enough gas to even make Pavlov. But one thing that I'd observed in the months before flying on the Alaska Peninsula and Aleutians was that on the Bering Sea, the streams which had run down from the mountains there and the snow-capped mountains, wherever they hit the Bering Sea coast, there was enough spread in the dew point and the temperature, so there was a thin rift in the clouds right above the intersection of the streams and the Bering Sea. And I knew I had to find one fast, and I headed for that direction. And just as I located a rift down there, one engine quit on the Boeing, which was a signal that I had about 5 minutes fuel left due to some intricacy of the fuel system. That engine always quit first. In any event, I I dove the Boeing down into this rift and followed, and I threw, it was pitch dark then. It don't stay light in western Alaska and south like that, like it does in the far northern Alaska. And I was able to see the phosphorus of the waves, and I went out, and just as I got hit the intersection, my engines quit, and the plane come tumbling down in the surf. Well, I was badly injured at the time, but I didn't know it. But in any event, I got out, and I got a rope around all my passengers on there, and I got in the surf, and I got them all to shore. And we huddled around there in the sand, and next morning, of course, next morning the tide went out, and I went out again, and I got my radio out of the plane. I had the radio demountable on there so that I could take it away from the plane and use it in any case of an emergency. So I set up an antenna on there and communicated my approximate position to the Air Corps station at Cold Bay, Alaska. Well, within about an hour, I had many friends in the 42nd and 54th Troop Carrier Squadron, and within an hour we were able to build a fire. We found that one had some dry matches, and we built a fire, and the smoke coming through, and they were dropping coffee and sandwiches and refreshments. It came raining down through the fog right by the fire, and we had to run a couple of hundred feet away to keep from getting hit. Well, that time there were one or two of the passengers that had been injured, and a Coast Guard plane piloted by Commander Johnny Martin flew in and evacuated the injured and the other passengers to the Dutch Harbor Hospital on there. And that night, Chief Warrant Officer Mike Utecht of the Surface Boats Rescue Service at Cold Bay came around through False Pass and picked me up and took me in. I found out later that as a result of the crash, I had been severely injured internally. And it was only until about a year or two ago, about 16 years later, that I finally got over the complete effects of the injury. It seemed that it dislodged my liver and pancreas and there, and as I say, I survived it. And I, like a lot of those things, I never went to what the Alaskans call a croaker on there. I always was my own doctor on there, and I'll tell you more about that later. Well, they got the radar to Amchitka, and about a week later on there, and I believed that to a great degree this must have contributed to the fact that the Japs evacuated Kiska without knowledge of the Navy and the Air Corps and the Army in that area there, and they did not have the tremendous loss of life which they anticipated having when they went out to take Kiska. You know, there were 2,000 Japs in that too, a little over 2,000, or 2,018 in fact. We had a very bloody battle on there, in our army killed every one of those Japs but six, which they took prisoner, and I imagine one or two of them surrendered. I didn't have any insurance on the aircraft, and there I was back where I started from with one beat up Fairchild. However, the engines had a certain value, and so some of my friends in the Army and that took a crash boat around and removed the engines. And I had them sold to a contractor here named Morrison Knudsen for $4,500, which represented quite a stake in those days on there. And I followed the process of those engines all the way from the crash boat through False Pass to Cold Bay and everything up to Fort Richardson, and I knew that the day they would arrive. And so I went out. I couldn't go out there that day. I had a flight, so I went the next day, and I saw the boxes with my name on it, but there are no engines there. And I said, "Where are my engines?" And nobody. There were a bunch of GIs standing around, and they didn't want to say anything. And says, "We don't know nothing about your engines." Well, I know that there was a pile of scrap there, and I said, "Those must be my engines on there. They look like the Hornet A2s, some of the parts on there." And finally, one young GI on there, he came over and he says, "Yes." He says, "Those are your engines, all right." He says, "Well, who smashed them up?" I said, "Well, There was an Air Corps general here named General McMullen came through here yesterday, and he says, where those engines come from? He says, I says, well, they belong to Bob Reeve. He says, I know, they're not, those are not American engines. He says, those are Jap engines. Smash them up for scrap. We tried to tell him they were your engine, but, he says, but you do what a general tells you and everything on there. Well, that fellow's name was Clements McMullen, and he had a name of concrete, which had given him because of the many air crashes he'd survived in the old days. So I wrote concrete, and I says, he says, how about my engines? He says, well, he says, I haven't got any money to pay for your engine, and no new one. Says, sue the government. Well, I says, by the time I sue the government and everything on there, I'll be dead and gone. I says, I got one thing out of this, so your name is Sledgehammer instead of Concrete. And I think he passed away a year ago, but I understand that nickname still stuck with him. I want to tell you an amusing incident that happened during this period, which was one of my finest hours. In the early days of flying in Fairbanks on there, none of the Bush private pilots, well, it was very rare that any of them had any credit around any place on there. They were all on a cash basis. I had inveigled $45 worth of gas out of the Standard Oil Company on there to use on a special project, which was sure, for which I alleged I was sure to be paid. And of course, you had to be persuasive in those days, and I still believe I must have been super persuasive to get this fuel. In any event, I did not get my money in time, and this fellow from the Standard Oil down there always used to tell me, he says, when are you going to pay that gas bill? Well, one time my wife ran out of oil when I was gone, and he wouldn't give her any oil on there until she paid that gas bill. Now, that may seem hard-hearted and everything on there, but that's part of the way of the old life in Alaska on there. But anyway, she borrowed some money from the neighbor and paid the $45 gas bill. And naturally, I was very irritated, exasperated about this. But a couple of years later, when I had this contract, I had a contract with the Army, and part of the contract was that they were to provide my fuel for me at cost. And in the meanwhile, there was this young second lieutenant came into the Elmendorf field, I hear, then Fort Richardson, and saw her. I'd got $31,000 worth of fuel without paying for it on there. He did not know about this contract, so he sent me a bill for $31,000. Well, I naturally took my contract out and showed it to him, and got the matter straightened out on there. But I kept the bill, and the next time I saw this Standard Oil collector up there in Fairbanks, I said, his name was Obie Ryanseth. I says, Obie, I says, you remember the times you used to be so worried about me when they only owed you $45 and you used to hound me and trying to collect it from me, also the time you wouldn't give my wife the oil until I paid the bill? He says, kind of hung his head, and he says, yes, and admitted and everything. As I imagine, he had a modest feeling of guilt about it. When I said, Obie, I said, I've got a new gas man now that I do business with here. Look, I got a $31,000 credit, and they only send me a bill once every 2 years. And I showed it to him. He turned it over, looked upside down, gave it back to me, walked away without a word. That was one of my finest hours. In relating this story, I well recall another incident of a similar nature that occurred to me down in Valdez in the early days. The merchants then were a lot more lenient with credit than they were now, or were up in Fairbanks. During this time, as I told you, that I went out and I found this rich outcrop of gold up in Columbia Glacier. Well, I'd been about a week, and I got in, and I had about 100 pounds of this real high grade in the sack. And I got in town, and the first thing I did was go down to the pin zone. That's our pool hall and everything on there, and showed all my old friends as high grade miners. And I want to tell you, and then I went over to Alex Singletary, who was our woods chemist, and I got a couple of quarts of moon, and we really had a time. And I want to tell you, that was a day when we were great fellows, great miners, and we believed in the brotherhood of man. Well, about 11 o'clock that night, And meanwhile, I'd been carrying a torch for a fair charmer that had come in town about several months ago, but not having the finances to go and take her to dances and ice cream cones. That's the terror that the boys with regular salaries had on there. I wasn't making much progress. And however, I had reached a new stage in life on there where I was, as I said, I would expect to be the next millionaire in Alaska with this high grade mine. So I went down to the dance where she was and searched her out. And of course, as I said, I had a week's whiskers and my old clothes on there, and I found out quickly that I was persona non grata, and probably some of the essence of the spurs fermenti emanating from Doc Singletary's moonshine may have scared her off also. But in any event, I said she suddenly, in protective way, surrounded herself by several of these boys she was dancing with, and Mr. Reeves says, "Don't want to dance with you." She says, "Well," I says, "better come dance with me." He says, "Next millionaire in Alaska." I struck it rich, and I think I must have made myself a little obnoxious. And anyway, she got away from me, but I found her. I cornered her a little later in the corner, and I said, "Says, don't stick around with those fellas on there. All you'll ever do is marry and have about five kids and wash your own dishes the rest of your life on there. You better go on and hitch up with me, because the next millionaire of Alaska on here." "Well," she said, "Mr. Reeves," she said, "I'm very interested in knowing that. I just got a reading on you, Mr. Millionaire." He says, "Well, what's that? About the new gold mine?" He says, "No." He says, "All these fellas that work around these various establishments, one tells me that you haven't paid your gas bill down at the dock company for over a year, and you owe over 11 months meal tickets at the Chinaman's and everything down there." And says, "That don't sound like a millionaire to me." I says, "Well," he says, "maybe not." I says, "But you can't deny I haven't got good credit around this town." Well, to make long story short, there's the old Alaska way. When I really started I got shaved up and got spruced up and got back on my good behavior, I got in their good standing. And I think when that night that she knew that she loved me and that I had found a rich gold mine. Well, you know what she's doing now? She's married to me and she's got five kids and washes her own dishes. Well, came the end of World War II. And the day it was over with, on air, I lay in bed, marvel that I was still alive. I'd been flying single engine Fairchild all over the Aleutians, over the open water, and I had really had some what the new boys would call really hairy experiences on there, which we old timers really paid no attention to. They were all part of the game. As I said, I just lay in bed and think I don't have to chug through the fog and the violent winds and everything on there, and so I took it a little easy there for a few days. Well, came 46, and I knew that there would come a demand for a scheduled airline down the Aleutians on there, but I had to have far better aircraft than the old Fairchilds or the old Boeings. And about that time, the War Surplus Corporation put up for sale several of the Douglas C-47s on there, which had been the workhorse of the Air Corps during the war. And through some of my friends out in the Air Corps, one in particular, Colonel Leslie Mulzer, one of my old Barnstorm companions in the United States, who was commanding officer of Elm North End, tipped me off that his private plane would be up for sale. Well, I got my name in a hat first, but I almost goofed that up on there. I got in a fight with a fellow named Dave Brown, who was handling the assets on it. He had been an old miner who had not paid me one of his bills in the old days on there, and those old in the old repercussion exploded almost. And his revenge was that he says, "I'm not going to sell you that tree." Well, for once in my life, the next morning I put my pride behind me. And I went to see him and says, "Dave, I forgive you for not paying that bill, but for the love and the Nipton hand of the deal, let me have that these 47. Well, I got the first 47 on there, and I converted to a DC-3 down in Spokane, Washington. And about that time, we had the boat strike. And in that period, in a period of approximately 53 days during the boat strike, I flew myself as a crew member, I think it was 463 hours on there. And I took in $90,000 in 53 days, and I was able to buy three more C-47 DC-3s, and I ended up there in 2 months with a complete airline, in fact. And at the same time, I started running, starting a schedule down the Aleutians to Cold Bay, Dutch Harbor, Umnak, and Adak, and Mchitkin, Shemyanatu, without any authority from the Civil Aeronautics Board. Well, my lawyer got after me one time, and he says, his name is John Hellenthal, they're an old Alaska family, and he said, Bob, he says, they're after you, he says, you better get an application for a route down there. Well, I eventually did, meanwhile, while I had been flying on the Seattle route, the Silver Aeronautics Board were asking me, why are you doing this without authority on there? They were become very conscious of the authority they exerted on this, and I finally got a certificate, a temporary certificate in 1948, and a permanent certificate some years later. Those were rough and rugged days. The pilots I'd hired were former fighter pilots on there, a very undisciplined bunch on there, and they flew any place, anywhere. They did a fine job. We didn't have any lining in our planes. I remember one aircraft that brought in a bunch of passengers one time on there. It was about 50 below, and colder in the air. And then they came jumping out of the plane on there, and he says, all we're doing is paying you for freezing to death. Well, I eventually went and put a lining in one of the planes for the women and the kids, at least. And we had a lot of trouble in those days with liquor. We had a very hard, tough bunch of construction workers on there. We were flying around to different jobs on there, and they used to get take a bunch of liquor with them on the aircraft and get drunk and shoot up and everything. And I told the boys on there, whenever they get drunk, just take them up, start going up 12, 14, 15, 16,000 feet till they pass out. And if they get obstreperous, just yank that stick back and put them on the ceiling and knock them off. Well, that worked fine on there, but every now and then we still had a liquor trouble. So I used to go, and every one there on the plane, I used to frisk them down there from head to foot and take their liquor away from them. And I always very apprehensive that somebody, they were all gonna jump on me like a pack of wolves. So I used to carry about a 5-cell flashlight that was loaded with a BB shot on there, under my arm on there, as a matter of self-protection. Well, even so, a lot of them used to get on a plane with liquor, and then I found out that they had been having bottles, and they would string them down their belt, and they would down in the air. So I began to get wise to that, and pretty soon we had a pretty clean running show in our airline on there. We used to take out with a load of passengers from here to Attu, 1,800 miles out, and we used to give all these people a box lunch, one box lunch on there, a big one too. And sometimes we made it in the day, and sometimes we get stuck 2 or 3 days en route. I'll never forget one occasion. I was sitting on a seat in the plane, and there were two fellas ahead of me, and came the time to serve the lunches out there by the co-pilot. And one fellow started eating his lunch very sparing, but the other fellow started to eat all of his lunch. And the old timer who had ridden with us before moved over, and he says, I'm going to give you a tip. He says, don't eat all that lunch this one time. That's going to last you all the way to Attu, and we may not be there for a week. One time, we hauled in the Adak Naval Base there, about 47 or 48, we took a load of whiskey and a whole load of whiskey in there, about 6,000-7,000 pounds, about 100 cases, or about 125, 30 cases. It was worth about $7,000 or $8,000, and we just got in there late at night. The next morning we went out, and there wasn't a single drop of whiskey left in the plane. The boys around the base there had climbed on top of the plane, got on the emergency hatch on the front, and got in, and every one of those cases were stolen on there, and the whole base was drunk. That wasn't a very profitable trip, because I had to go out and replace all that whiskey on there just for public relations, no event on there. And after that, we unloaded the whiskey, turned it over to somebody as fast as we could when we got there. Well, the meanwhile, I was going through the throes and ramifications of having getting our airline qualified under CAB and CAA regulations and so forth. And I'll never forget the tough time we had getting our proving run on to get our operating certificate. We went out time and time after all, and every time we'd go out, to the inspectors would find more false widgets on there. But I finally got it through, and we got our operating certificate. In the meanwhile, came a time to get my mail rate settled by the board on there. Well, I had kept close track of operations on there, and I figured that I had about $75,000 coming from the CAB in back mail pay, of which I owed that amount and much more in debts that I had for dispatch and radio equipment and facilities and so forth that are all pertinent to a scheduled airline operation. So we had our mail rate hearing, and all through the hearing, the theme, I brought up the theme that I had this back $75,000 coming. Well, at the end of the deal, the examiner was very hesitant, and he said, I want to correct one misapprehension that you have, Mr. Reeve. He says, we don't owe you $75,000. He says, you owe us $64,000 in overpayments we made. He says, you bought a bunch of surplus engines on there and everything, and you've got that in 10-year supply, and we have to disallow that supply and only give you a tenth of that, for the reason that the CAB only allows a year's supply on hand at a time. Well, in the meanwhile, all my creditors are after me, times were very tough in those days. I had a local bank. I had a credit of $50,000, which, regardless of what I owed to others, I always kept that my payments current on that $50,000 for operating capital. Well, the word had got around, of course, that I was broke, and the banker on there, he not understanding the ramifications of the Civil Aeronautics Act, where I would eventually get some money in back pay and pay in back mail pay and become solvent on there, refused to renew this loan. And there I was, and everybody said, you better go bankrupt, file bankruptcy on there. Well, I was down to Seattle at the time, and I tried to number the other banks that I'd done business with, but they said, no, if that cagey old fellow don't want to do it, we don't want anything to do with you. Well, I finally got a friend of mine here in town named Elmer Rasmussen of the National Bank of Alaska, who understood the Civil Aeronautics Act. He finally, I went to him with my troubles, and I got a loan of $125,000 on there, which put us back into shape, and we started getting healthy again, business coming in. But in those days on there, getting an airline started, especially out the Aleutians on there, I had, in effect, if an actor, more silent vice presidents in my business on there than any business in the world, between the Federal Communications Commission and the tax people and the Air Force and the Navy and the Coast Guard and the Army and the FAA and the CAA and the Interior Department, just to mention a few on there.
on there. We, due to the, we were very oppressed with trying to get along and do business with all these people on there. For instance, the Interior Department here had the jurisdiction of the Pribilof Islands, the Navy had jurisdiction of ADAC and ATU and Dutch Harbor and the Air Corps in Shenyang and Coal Bay, and then the FAA. And when I got my temporary certificate, there was a clause in there, a gimmick, which said if Reeve, when we give this certificate to Reeve out here, the government, federal government, is not under any obligation to put up the money to run air nav aids for him or airfields in his place in case any of the services choose to pull out. Well, what happened? Some lawyer out here, the Judge Advocate's Department, reading through my certificate, and they found this, and of course they must have suspected that I wasn't going to lose my airline, so they one by one they started moving out of these fields out here. Well, we had to take practically all of them over. We took over Umnak, for example, where it was been run by 100 men. We ran it with 2 men, and Port Hyden and Dutch Harbor and Coal Bay on there, all those fields for several years. We were running these former airtime fields the best we could with our own money on there, with all the services pulling out. And the there, for instance, Shemya. I'll never forget in Shemya what a battle I had to go on Shemya. The Air Force had a budget of $1 million put in to go and operate Shemya, but at that time there was a battle going on between General Hoyt Vandenberg, who was chief of the Air Corps, and the FAA, then the CAA, as to the responsibility of who should run Shemya, since it had become an important overseas stop on the overseas carriers, principally Northwest Airlines. Well, I went down to the Air Coordinating Committee on there and tried to get them to replace this $1 million in, and they were very, very backward about it, and it ended up in a big row on there. And they told me, he says, Shemya is for the birds, feathered, that is. Well, I thought I was licked in this. I was going out of the federal building, the CAA building there in Washington. I ran into an old friend of mine, the main General Sam Anderson, who was in Hoyt Vandenberg's operations staff on there. And I says, he heard something about my trouble, and he said, I said, we're licked out of Shem, and you are too, because I know darn well that you've got a bunch of B-36s flying over there all the time, and you haven't got any place to come down to roost or anything, and tell me the trouble, and you're worse trouble than I am, because I don't have to fly in there, and you do. And he rushed on and seen General Vandenberg. And he got General Vandenberg to change 2 words in his letter, that it was military desirable, and we got our $1 million from Shemya on there. That's just one of the examples of the harassment and the tribulations on there that befronted anybody trying to run an airline, of all places, the Aleutians. Well, in the meantime, we were operating principally DC-3s and Amphibians down the peninsula in the Aleutians on there, and we had a very successful little airline on there. We used to gross about $700,000 or $800,000 a year and end up with about a 10% profit on there, and our business was about 97-98% straight commercial on there, which is a very desirable mode of making a living when you're not in human bondage to the government contracts and the whims of the federal government to do things 1 year and not spend any money the next year on there. Well, came along on there incidentally, to get back to this Shemya business on there. Within a few days after we saved Shemya there, the Korean War started, and Shemya became the most important stop on the North Pacific Ocean on there, with the thousands of soldiers going over in their battle gear and the wounded coming back, and the supplies they give. Shemya was the most important stop in the North Pacific Ocean, and in support of the Korean War. Well, I say in the meanwhile came the Russian threat on there, and with Khrushchev and Stalin, his predecessor, and everything there rattling the sword and it became obvious on there that we had that our that we had to get some early warnings system in, on there. In this phase, we did the first flying on the Dew Line in northern Canada. From the Canadians did not have the know-how of the airplane, so they called us in, and we flew all the men and everything between Edmonton and Cambridge and Prairie Point on the Amundsen Gulf on there. And that was some feat, I want to tell you that. We used to take off, fly 4,000 miles up there over the Arctic Slope and the Arctic Ocean on there with one air navigational aid between Edmonton and the Amundsen Gulf. We completed that job and came back here, and I well recall some of the things we used to do in construction of some of our stations close to Anchorage. For example, in Paravan, which is a distant early warning station about 192 statute miles directly west of here, we flew in over 1,000 tons of fuel there one day.